everyone. I'm Mary O'Brien, an associate of Wilson Sonsini. Thank you for joining our Electronic Gaming Group podcast. Today, we have a special guest-hosted episode featuring a conversation between Jonathan Chan, a partner in Wilson Sonsini's corporate department in our Palo Alto office, and Justin Woodward, the co-founder and creative director of Interabang Entertainment, the co-founder of the Media Indie Exchange, the founder of Black Voices in Gaming, and the lead advisor on the Black Game Dev Fund. Before Justin and Jonathan dive in, we would like to remind you that the information in this podcast is for general information purposes only and may not reflect current law in your jurisdiction. Nothing in this podcast should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation, and this information is not intended to create, and receipt or listening does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. No listener of this episode should act or refrain from acting on the basis of any information included in or accessible through this episode without seeking legal or other professional advice from an appropriately licensed professional in the recipient state, country, or other appropriate jurisdiction. Without any further ado, let's turn it over to Justin and Jonathan.
All right, I am here. This is Justin Woodward. You know, this is The Mix. I'm with Jonathan Chan from Wilson Sonsini, and we're going to get to just have a conversation about video games, publishing, law.
AI
and law, maybe.
Games,
IP, all kinds of the stuff that developers are looking for when they're trying to release their games. And then, I don't know, we could just kind of go from there. So where are things at as far as publishing and law right now? It's very broad, I know.
I would say games are, the market hasn't really changed in terms of how games are being developed. What has changed a bit is the sources of capital. There's been a lot more venture capital firms created focused on video games and mega funds, A16Z's $1 billion.
What are mega funds?
Just funds that are $1 billion and more dedicated to
games. Oh, okay.
That's new. And that, I think, can stave off some of the need to go to publishers. But publishers are always looking for games. And maybe I ask you the same question, which is, have you seen a drop-off in going to publishers because maybe new sources of capital from investors are available?
I mean, I think it's really interesting because I'm a little bit seasoned when it comes to like communicating with publishers and first party and things like that. I think what I've seen is there's just multiple ways to do it. I've got multiple games in production. I try not to spend my own money on things, especially if it's a little bit more risky. I want to mitigate the risk by utilizing some funds that are already available, put in some of my funds and like take that risky bet that I think is going to win. And I think that a lot of developers, especially if they've had any kind of success, start to see that this is a possibility of a way to go. I think younger developers who are just getting into the game kind of view it. It's kind of like the record industry or the music industry where they're like trying to get signed to some kind of label, but don't really understand the ins and outs and like what they're actually trying to provide. But I do also see that angel investment, different accelerators and not accelerators. What are the other?
Incubators.
Yeah. Like those are popping up. And so developers are saying that there's other ways to fund their games.
Yeah.
Also prototype funds, like I help run a prototype fund with Humble. And then there's other ones that are coming out. Netflix has prototype funds. And
does that mean the traditional publishers are easier to work with because they have more competition in terms of like
licensing
agreements, publishing agreements as well?
Yeah, they can't be as aggressive in their publishing agreements because they're going to lose great games, right?
Well, have you seen developers raise enough money from investors and not publishers to kind of pursue a self-publishing route? Or did they, in the end, always try to welcome having a publisher to deal with the marketing and distribution of those games?
I think, again, it depends on where the developer's at in their tenure and understanding of developing games and producing games. But I think that the threshold is lower for developers to receive funding from alternative investment opportunities outside of publishing. So then publishers are now competing with other investment types, right? And so also they're competing with each other. There's a lot of games, there's a lot of indies, but these indies know that there's like 50 different indie publishers. So they're like shooting their shot at all these publishers to get a deal. When they're looking at all these different deals, especially if they're highly sought after, they know that Tiny Build and Raw Fury and White Thorn Digital or whatever it is, the terms have to be compatible.
Is there a standard set of platforms they're trying to launch on? Like, what's the preferred route now to get a developer game out? Is it PC, mobile? I mean, mobile is always crowded, but console, like, what's the path that indies mostly take?
I would say indie devs mostly... Well, they have to go multi-platform. You're not going to make money. I think that's the biggest thing, unless it's very specified.
And we're talking installed games too, not like service-based games.
I think the interesting thing is games are as a service. I think indies have to make games as a service. But when it comes to that, it doesn't cost millions if you release a game on PlayStation, Steam, mm-hmm. Xbox, and.
But is the go-to like PC first, or do they try to find a deal with the console?
I mean, personally, and here's the thing, right? Like the education of the developer, when developers start to realize that publishers are mitigating their risk by doing deals with platform holders and like all the money that they've raised to make the game has already been paid off, yeah. They're going to start going that route too. But I mean, right now with Unity and Unreal and now Game Maker and some of these other tools, it's almost a push of the button to release a game multi-platform because right. they're all pretty much mm-hmm. PCs at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So typically developers develop their game for Steam PC first and then work on deploying the multi-platform. And that's where publishers come into play, depending on how far they are in development, is that the admin work to release a game on those other platforms is the most time consuming mm-hmm. aspect of it. So right now they're like, they got to hit all the platforms, right? Like that's what they're, except mobile. Mobile is like you're saying, games as a service is way more difficult. That's millions of dollars of, you have to figure out your algorithm, you know, your ad spend, and then you have to constantly be A/B testing the different drops that you're having, and indie devs can't do that.
Well, would you say that you're working with a publisher, like I think a publisher seems to make sense in the mobile for a mobile game for that reason. Do you think it also makes sense for the console platform as well?
I think it makes sense for every, mm-hmm. it just depends on what the developer needs.
And then what are the, I've heard this from my clients before, but one of the classic questions is, should I try to own the IP that I'm creating or try to strike a deal and get better economics, not necessarily owning my IP, but then, you know, having enough success to then think about the next sequel rather than trying to hold on tight to their IP of the current game. So that must be like one of the classic questions that.
Well, I think it's different. I'm interested to hear what you've seen because you're dealing on on a higher scale, right? Or you can answer after I answer your question. But I would say this, that like, again, we were talking about competition. They're not asking for their IP. First of all, they don't want their IP because they don't even know if it's going to hit. So they'll wait till it hits. Then the publisher would try to figure out whether they want to acquire the studio that developed the IP or buy the IP outright. But it has to be extremely strong. But most publishing deals, they're like 1 to 5 years. They don't go for the IP situation because developers, especially indie developers, don't want to go for that. I would say that platforms, if they're going to be putting 5 million plus into a game or maybe even lower than that, that they would request mm-hmm. IP rights. But again, if you're a very talented developer, most of the developers that they would even consider doing that, they wouldn't take that deal. Because I could release it myself.
Maybe extending beyond IP then, just they're probably like sequel rights, et cetera. It's probably a trade-off between, let me work with this publisher, I'm giving up something, maybe like some sort of exclusivity, in exchange for, you know, a greater commercial success for the game. Like, is that a bargain that you always advise your developers to take?
It depends on their leverage, and I think that's the main thing. You know, most publishers will ask for first right to negotiations mm-hmm. or first right to refusal for sure, and that would include sequels and spinoffs mm-hmm. and like that type of thing. But I would say again, like the leverage aspect of it and the duration of that would mm-hmm. depend on where are they coming in the game. If they're coming in with $2 million and all they had was like an amazing concept, then the publisher's going to have more leverage to push on those things. But if the developer's coming in and there's only 6 months left in the game development and they just want distribution, mm-hmm. porting, and marketing support, then they're not going to be able to push that aspect of things too hard. You know, one of the things I would say, though, is that developers don't understand is most publishers want a long-term relationship as opposed to a one-off game and that's it, because they know if they have a good, solid developer who's releasing good stuff, then their third game is probably going to be a hit, right? Or maybe a hit. So they're not going for that.
Are you seeing then, it does seem like the market's currently in a way that kind of more even-handed with developers and publishers. And are you seeing developers having a lot of success working with publishers? Is that a pretty active market still?
I think so, but they always sneak in boilerplate. Mm-hmm. It's always, you know, you see some dumb stuff, and if they'll go for it, they're going to take it. And then later on, because there's some, I'm not even going to lie, there's some publishers that are just kind of pop-ups. And so when I'm talking to developers, because I work with so many publishers, I'll tell them, I'll identify. And I'll I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but sometimes I was like, just shoot me your contract. Let me just look it over.
I mean, you're not a lawyer, but you know the business terms.
I know the gist of it. And they always try to sneak. I think it's getting less and less because folks like Raw Fury, the indie houses, you know, White Thorn, these folks are sharing their terms openly and they're very transparent about it. And so when they share those online, when you see, you know, these other term sheets and it looks suspect, it's just it's easier to compare them.
And I think maybe developers don't realize that they can just call me up and I'm willing to take a look. And I think lawyers are always happy to have that first conversation and give them some thoughts and decide whether it makes sense for them to work together. And so there's no reason for them to, you know, be in a situation where they're not informed.
Yeah, well, I think it's they're scared, right? When they hear legal or lawyers, they don't understand that, this is part of the game. You have to have lawyers at all times to communicate, even if it's just to look over your stuff. And also, it's similar to developers and artists. It's, again, it's all relationship driven. So they'll be like, oh, but, you know, I'm going to get this animation, but, you know, I got to pay him $35 an hour for 14 frames. It's like, nah, man, you have a communication with artists and you say, hey, would you mind checking this out and give me some feedback on what an estimate would be? And then they would do it. Most lawyers that I've communicated with or work with, they're not a straight up you took 25 minutes. I took 25 minutes of this, you know, looking at your contract, so you owe me $236. It's so they get scared getting into starting the conversation because they don't understand what.
And they don't realize that that type of lawyer is not going to be very successful.
And you don't even want to work with that type of lawyer.
And the lawyers that are successful are the ones that build that relationship and trust over time. And ultimately just want to have developers succeed. As they grow, they'll have more legal needs down the line. And it's just having that longer term view, I guess, of that relationship.
So just to jump off of that same question, what have you seen? Because you're working on the upper echelon of these deals. How have you seen these deals kind of transpire as far as ownership of IP and things like that?
Well, my clients are mostly venture backed. And they receive funding from investors. So it kind of decreases the pressure of going on getting a publisher. Those typically, they usually have access to capital from investors to the point where they may be able to, you know, skip a publishing relationship, or it's just much further down the line. My suspicion though is because capital is more readily available, the publishers need to work harder at getting content. And, you know, the publishers are usually large companies and there's something they're trying to, they're not looking at just getting revenues. They're looking for strategic motivations for having those deals. And so they're probably, looking for different rights here and there with the developer. And I think developers kind of are sophisticated enough to understand that. And like you say, they find different ways of scraping together financing to delay that as much as they can.
Yeah, they're definitely getting more sophisticated. I would say this, it's really interesting, is it's like such a different game. When I started doing the VC thing, when we start raising capital, I didn't really understand how that works, and that when I started getting in the room with VCs, that all of them were giving money to each other. Either they're giving money to each other or they're giving money to their friends, and their friends are great. They have great games. I'm not saying that they're getting, it's like some weird
But you're breaking Illuminati. Into maybe a culture.
It's a culture, and I think that is daunting if you don't understand the culture. And I think we talked about this before, too. Getting in the indie culture is a culture in itself, right? And so, like, when you start to become friends with the other indies, you're raising each other up and you're right. sharing these deals. Then I start to get into, like, the culture of publishers and then first party. So it's easy for me to ask for capital from these folks. But then when I start to get into the, it's like a different network. Mm-hmm. And so.
Yeah, when we as a firm have represented a lot of large video game companies like Zynga and Bungie recently in their sales. But as we were thinking about the indie market, we thought we needed to change our approach. And that's why it rolled out initiatives like the Nest program, which is a set of legal accelerator, I guess. Like you said, a lot of accelerators are popping up. We have a legal accelerator in Nest that has like a package of legal services that are affordable for indie companies. It kind of decreases the, you know, intimidation, I guess, and that, hey, these are a bunch of services that we're actually making free and available to indie game companies, no strings. And we have our own webpage that looks different than our, you know, firm website. And working with indie developers like yourself to be introduced into the that market as not a scary actor, that's kind of the approach we've been taking. It is important to think through, like, the games industry is massive, but there's so many different subcultures of that large industry, and I think it's important to sort of tailor how you're approaching each one.
As developers are getting more sophisticated and, like, understanding their needs, the publishers really need to really have more accountability for what they're doing, and developers need to understand what the publishers bring to the table. Like, you have folks like, I'll just toss out Tiny Build, which they're an engineering publisher. So when they take you under their wing, they are not only providing capital, but they're also providing engineer support, potentially production support. They'll have their manpower. And some of these publishers are just like, here's $200,000, but we really don't have anything to offer. Mm-hmm. And those are typically bad deals because you really need someone to have a juxtaposed position as far as that you have weaknesses right. in, right. right? And so there's deals, and you've probably seen this, you know, catalog deals where they just scrape up as many indies as they can, put them in their catalog. They'll offer like $60,000 to $100,000 or maybe $200,000, and then they have these indies in their pocket and they can't get out of this mm-hmm. situation.
Are you seeing that with a lot of the subscription services? Is that proliferating?
That is for real the situation, but it's not as bad because they offer a lot of money and they mm-hmm. don't hold you. It'll be difficult more in the future yeah. when you can't make digital sales.
Well, there's always the classic question of if you have a subscription, how do you compensate? Because again, like, the games industry is huge. There's different types of games. Some games are really good, but they're short puzzle games. Others are really long games. And if you do something like, say, by time, you could undercompensate the really interesting indie game, because it's just a natural, shorter experience. So it's tricky compensating different types of games in the subscription packages.
Yeah, I think so. I think the good folks like PlayStation and Xbox, they're reliant on curation, you know, and so they want the best games, which I think is a good thing. So they're kind of a gatekeeper in that way. So when they're making offers, the offers are pretty substantial to an indie developer, which would potentially pay for the amount they spent with their, I was going to say, blood, sweat, and tears, or the sweat equity. It doesn't really hold them back too much, because it'll be like, you can't go on another subscription platform for a year or 2 years unless they try to buy them out completely, and then they would have a bag right ready right. for them with cash. But since it's only tailored for subscription, they could still make digital sales. And then also you're utilizing that for marketing. If you look at what happened to Rocket League was really, really smart in the sense that in their first week, I think, after they were doing beta, same thing with the Fall Guys, they offered on PlayStation mm-hmm. right, for free. So then they had millions of people playing their game, which pushed them up to the top. So every time they saw people right. play, you know, it had all of these like high ratings. So then when it went on sale, you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. those kind of plays right. are important.
And how do people get that advice? I mean, that's publishing advice, but that's, you don't necessarily need to have a publisher to do all that.
What do you mean?
The idea of like how to roll out the game, how to take advantage of these different promotions. A developer doesn't necessarily need to work with a publisher to do this.
Yeah, they can do correct. It. Yeah.
yeah. And how do they get, I mean, how do they learn this? It's talking to other indie developers, or is there kind of a playbook that's kind of shared around?
I think we should build a playbook. I think that would be really dope. It would be like, I mean, just a book in general would be really good. I think it's just communication with other indies. Yeah. Publishers don't share this because they don't want to share this information, because then how do they have leverage over the developer? And that's the part that kind of sucks. Like, I would say, like,
I guess you can always try ChatGPT and see what comes out of that.
That's, yeah, I mean, maybe, like,
what about the new platforms, like any new platforms that are interesting? Netflix, I've seen, is investing a lot more in games. Epic Store,
I think, well, Epic is really interesting because they have the Unreal 5 engine and they just updated that. Netflix is really interesting. We're, I don't know if I told you this, but we just signed a deal with them to do an accelerator for Black Voice in Gaming. So,
cool. Would they have an accelerator or
no? We have an accelerator.
Oh, you're working with them.
We're working with them. Cool. So they're helping to fund the accelerator for a 12-week program, but they do the catalog approach, like you're saying. So they, with their,
because
movies,
no one's paying additional on top of their Netflix subscription.
Yeah, exactly. So they're trying to get, but the main thing is they're starting with mobile, and then in the future, everything is going to be pretty much subscription based. I think Xbox is on the forefront of that. And then PlayStation Plus and stuff. And Netflix wants to be there when hardware is agnostic, pretty much. So, but their approach is kind of that we're talking about with publishers, is like a catalog approach. And they're all catalog approaches. Even if it isn't a subscription model, it is very much catalog. So if like...
Well, it's just like their movies, their content, their TV.
Yeah.
You got to have something for everyone. Or you got to have everything for something for... So that there's something for someone.
Yeah, and they do deals like the Chappelle thing, where it's like Dave Chappelle did 5 stand-ups and they gave him $40 million. I don't know that the numbers are right, but it's like that. Or like there's a rapper, I think his name is Cameron. They gave him $20 million to make 6 movies just so there's content on the platform. And he made whatever it cost him, he made those 6 movies and dropped them. So Netflix is like in a similar position, and so is like Xbox and PlayStation, where they're like, look, we're messing with Devolver, we're messing with whatever indie, Maximum Games or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you guys show me your catalog? Yeah. You got 6. One of them's gonna blow up.
Yeah, it seems that it would make sense that they'd go to, like, there's so many games, and there might be even more games with AI, that it makes sense that they would go to the tastemakers, like the curators, the publishers.
Exactly, because like, look, you already did the work of curating these games. You already have skin in the game. You already pay for these games. So, like, what do you got? Yeah, I think that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think maybe we could talk. We should talk about AI, because
that'd be interesting.
Since you brought it up,
we're obviously seeing it very active in the venture space, where more and more startups are starting in that sector, and then a lot of the fundraising is in AI right now, and it's just like AI meets this, AI meets games. You know, there's a lot of those new businesses. And it's a new area, so the legal issues around AI are really novel and complex. And you know, I think it's fun to play with, but then when you're getting to the point of actually making a business out of it or commercializing it, that's when you really need to have things buttoned up from an IP, privacy, bias standpoint. What have you seen sort of in the indie market?
It's really interesting. I'm curious of how you could even regulate this, because like, say you got, I don't know if you're familiar with just like talking about art, right, and music and stuff like that. Basically, even if you do it locally, you have to feed it models. So the models, like say I want to come up with like a new design for a character, you have to feed it thousands of different models to figure out where it comes from. But where do those models come from? Those models, unless it's real like pictures, then it's going to
be other artists. It might be other people's IP. Right?
Exactly. So how do you regulate that when you come up with something that does look unique, but the style looks like, can you regulate the style of an artist through thousands of images that they've created? It's like an interesting place, but it's hard to identify. So what I'm seeing is, and I'm using this myself, is I've been really jumping into like, I don't know if you know Midjourney. Midjourney is like the art.
Oh yeah, the art, generative art.
Yeah, but it's like really robust.
But you don't know where that.
I don't know where that's coming from. But
whether you can commercialize that or not.
Yeah, but if I'm looking at like Stable Diffusion, that is more of local or in the cloud, like AI generative art, and you feed it the models and you create based
on that.
You
can feed your, if you're making a game, you could feed your own art into it, I guess, to generate like a sequel or
you could yeah, but I mean most likely system. But most likely they're not going to do that because these are like, for instance, I help with the creative direction of our games, some of our games, right? So I'm working with artists all the time. A lot of their art is contrived from other people's shit, right? Like, yo, this looks like Dragon Ball art. You're clearly emulating, you know, the artist here. So
I'm no creator, but I think that people take influence often, right? Inspiration from other artists.
They do. I have a bunch of art books upstairs. Sometimes they'll just have the art books and then they're, I'm not saying they're copying them, but it's clearly that. So what I'm basically saying is if I'm trying to find some concept art for the game that I'm making, I'll go to Midjourney or go to one of these other, like Stable mm-hmm. Diffusion, or go to these generative.
But you're using it to generate ideas?
Ideas, yeah.
Not necessarily to generate product.
Not product, yeah. But I think that that's where it's going to get blurred, and I don't know. Like,
It's like a brainstorming tool.
For me. It's mm-hmm. like, yeah, concept. One thing I would say, though, it's getting so complex that now you could take 2D art, like you could put in one of these tools, and you could say turnaround of a space alien, and then it creates literally all every perspective. And
3D
then,
images or 3D objects from that.
2D. Mm-hmm. And you use another tool, and the other tool maps it out into 3D and puts the bones in it. Then you look at, like...
Well, I don't think it's crazy to think that you can create a game with a sentence, right?
So that's what I'm saying. That's where it's going to go, especially when you're looking at these more retro games. Pretty soon, you're going to be able to say, I want a 2D side-scrolling game that mixes Contra with Mario, and I want the character to be Shrek.
Like, do you think of that as a serious threat, or you know that a machine will never be able to program fun, and there's just something intangible about the art of games that a machine will never get?
I think it's
even though it's possible to do all that, it doesn't mean anything to you because
it doesn't mean anything to me, but it means that everyone needs to step their game up on understanding the fundamentals of game design and art, those type of things, because then it's going to be flooded with all this crap. We're already getting to the point where there's like so much crap out there. It's hard mm-hmm. to sift through. So like you were talking about, the tastemakers are going to be, going to be like the more prolific.
Like the Twitch and the Twitch streamers, the publishers.
Influencers are going to mean so much more. Publishers are going to mean so much more because like people are not going to know where to look to find good content because it's going to be pumping out from everywhere. But it'll be really an interesting renaissance.
Some of it you can be a powerful tool for harnessing developers too. Like I just think about something like voice, where normally very expensive. You hire a voice actor to speak all the words in the game, and now you could probably synthesize that pretty well with AI technology.
I honestly think it's a good tool. It's just going to make game development so much better. From a director's standpoint, from really good developers, they're going to be able to do so much with so much less capital. Like just the stuff that I'm able to do now with it, it allows me to be more free with our design and productivity. We don't need like 30-man studios to do.
What might be interesting too is I know you work with a lot of underrepresented developers, and if it's easier and cheaper to build a game, then it may open up game making for other parts of the population, right? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean it's just the evolution of the tools anyway. Like 10 years ago, the tools weren't as robust as they are now with Unity and Unreal, even though they were around. Now it's so much more easy to implement certain things. People have plugins and
further democratize game making.
Yeah, I think so too. The way that I like to see it is it's kind of like, this sounds maybe ridiculous, but the Beatles, and you know, when guitars were more readily available and they saw all these different bands popping up. Now you got garage bands and you can buy your own amps and all this other stuff. And not that they will equal the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, but they feel like they're a part of that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That culture, because they're now creating as well. I think that, or hip hop, right? You have a mic, you have a recorder, you have turntables. A lot of people became DJs after that stuff was readily available and a lot cheaper. Yeah. So, I mean, now everybody's a filmmaker because you can make films on your
phone. What do you think that means for the indie developer? Like, is it going to be harder for them to succeed, have a way of life building games? Because gets increasingly easy to crit a game.
I think it makes the competition tougher. The main issues is the platform holders will have more power. Like, you're seeing this right now with Spotify, right? And Tidal and all these other. If you don't get on a playlist as an artist, you're kind of screwed. And then in music, it's like, you know, publishers are trying to do these 360 deals where they own your merch and they own like your touring and that type of thing. But artists, they make a lot of money touring. If you're like Spotify, you're getting like 0.01 cent, you know what I mean? Cent per play, and you got to get a billion streams in order to make $100,000. Then how do you make your money if you're building your own fan base and you own that fan base? And I think that that's what's really interesting is the music industry is 15 years ahead of the game industry, and we're going down the same exact path. Mm-hmm. But it's, since it's not performative, although I think it will be performative, it makes it a little bit more difficult for developers to have the leverage.
Do you think that what that looks like is creating a game with like an IP universe that then you can like generate other offshoots like toys and anime and movies?
That's
and
exactly it. Like
all that.
It has to be, you have to.
And you may not make money on the actual digital gameplay, but on those other things.
Yeah. You have to think of it as a franchise now. You can't just make a game and just think it's going to do numbers. It's like, it's like, where's the movie? Where are the toys? Like, how is this appealing to, you know, your, the other thing is like,
that might be an area where AI may not be able to figure out that strategy.
It definitely.
Or execute on it.
It definitely won't. Yeah. Yeah. But it is fascinating. I mean, it will be pretty easy to make games. Simple stuff. Like, it's not going to mean that they're great.
Well, I think it kind of exists in other environments already. Like you say, Unity has democratized mobile game development. Roblox, you know, people can create games on Roblox.
Yeah. It gets to the point where because I look at so many games for the mix in the Guerrilla Collective, where I could spot like something. Mm-hmm. I was like, yo, when I, for instance, I think when I was doing, cause I help with the Black Game Developer Fund, and I'll like look through a bunch of games. I'm like, oh, they used this model set and it looks really whack. Or you could tell that they used this, this plugin or like, you know, this pre-created game, like first person shooter set or whatever, and I'm like, oh, that's whack as hell. People are gonna start to tell.
Yeah, it's like the Uncanny Valley, right? Maybe, you know, where the AI may be able to create a game, but on the edges you can tell that it doesn't have the polish that's needed for people to really get into it.
Yeah, and that's another thing. I've been talking about this for years. Like, we did a showcase in Amsterdam with Unity and we had an open submission for games, and there were like, it was ridiculous because it was Unity. There was like 800 games we had to go through, right? And I worked with the Unity, Made with Unity folks. If you remember the Made with Unity folks, it was around the time when we were at Fig. The Uncanny Valley thing is really interesting because it's the Uncanny Valley of a developer not creating a style for their game. So the tools are so powerful now, you can get to a point where they almost look as good as a AAA, but there's something always off about it. If you're the average gamer, you can sense it. It's like if you like look at a painting and the perspective is slightly off. It's the Uncanny Valley. Right. It's like,
we had that at Fig too, where we got
a
ton of games and they all look great, but it's,
there's some weird
these all look like eights, but where's a 9 and 10 here?
Yeah, or even like it looks like an 8, but then when you play the game, the platforming is off, or like the physics are off, or something like really whack, and it's because they're not recognizing that they need to get it to the fidelity that they can afford to to make the game at, instead of trying to make a Call of Duty. Like a cel-shaded shooter that only focuses on these
things. It may be good enough for like the lay gamer or the regular person, but the gamers have really sophisticated tastes.
Yeah, there's too much competition. If you have Game Pass, you're gonna have to really go off the wall with everything. So that's the main thing when I tell developers is like, Activision isn't going to make, you know what I mean, this crazy game. They're going to stick to something that they know is going to work. So you have to really go as creative as possible. So
tell me more about, just switching gears a bit here, tell me more about your work with Black Voices in Gaming, and what is the state of underrepresented developers in the games industry?
I mean, it's somewhat complicated. The interesting aspect of it is just the lack of opportunity for these developers, you know, and like a lack of understanding where they can get the resources to develop their games, or where do they build the network to build
the lack of peers that they can talk to, like a network of other fellow gamers.
I think that's the main thing. So we, like with Black Voice in Gaming, we created a Discord channel. I've been communicating with them. I've been through the Humble Black Game Developer Fund, funding them and then mentoring them and introducing them to folks like you through Wilson Sassini, like, and other legal folks, animation studios, so they know that they can actually make these things happen. That it's because some folks will just see something and just say it just feels so far off. It feels so distant and foreign to them that they don't think it's possible.
Right.
And I would also
they say they're not in the network. They don't realize how much goodness is.
So
it's just a matter of plugging them in.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, especially in like let's say like Black culture or other cultures, what's pushed is more of the influencer thing. It's always surface level, right? It's like, I want to be that. You got to be the rapper. You got to be the athlete, or you got to be this performer, right? Entertainer, as opposed to the person that's building the foundation and the building blocks to make games, right? So that's a problem. So like what is pushed towards these communities is esports. Oh yeah, my cousin is making $100,000 a year playing Madden. It's like, okay, that's great. Like that's 1%. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you can make, it's not a ton of money, but like you can make $60,000, $80,000 being a texture artist and working in Unreal and build something and then own a piece of the equity in this company. And then you're, you know, you have long-term longevity in the game industry and wealth, right? A sustainable career.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what's pushed in the Black communities. And it's not just Black communities. I think it's just people who don't understand the industry. And that's where things get weird. And they need to know that, look, we shouldn't just be pushing the performative aspect of it and then that you could actually make these games. It's actually more viable for you to make games than for you to perform playing 2K. Like, you're basically marketing for people. Even the people who make $100,000 a year playing games, like, you're marketing for EA. Like, that's not, you know what I mean? Like, you're being utilized for that, and that's fine. I would say this, it's interesting because we've been working with Capcom and some other folks, you know, help them with some QA stuff just kind of on the side because we have a relationship with them. And I'm talking to some of the top players in that, in Street Fighter and all this other stuff. They don't make anything. You know, you have to like get endorsement deals. You have to like be a YouTuber. You have to really strive to do that.
And you have to keep your skills up.
Which
is
and
also then, hard.
And when you're like 35 with a baby and you're playing Street Fighter and like you cap out at like $30,000 of winnings a year, that's like, that's nothing. So,
and you think it's because, it sounds like part of it is being exposed to other roles in the games industry, being part of the production, development of games, publishing. That's not as visible.
The layman thing is,
do you almost kind of maybe need to have like a maybe an internship program where you're like cycling through different departments at a video game company? Could be interesting.
It just needs to be more exposed. I think it will unfold in the exposure. It's like what I was saying, like the music industry, like, you know, like when you watch a movie, you watch a Marvel movie, it doesn't end there. You go on YouTube and look at all of these like breakdowns of Ant-Man or whatever the hell it is, right? It's gonna be the same with developers, but it just hasn't spread to folks who are destitute or in struggling communities. They don't have the time to digest that. I think also, if you have a single parent, I had a single parent household. My mom worked like 3 jobs when I was 16, and my mom provided for me. I had every video game system you could think of, so I'm not even gonna front, like, middle class. But at the same time, I was never taught financial intelligence or any of these things, right? So a lot of that stuff I had to learn on my own, and I didn't have any additional money. It's like she lived paycheck to paycheck. She bought a condo for us to live in and all these other things. But if I look at the folks that have more privilege, and there's no hate on that, you should have more privilege. Some of the people in the game industry, they're able to like say, oh, I want to work in the attic. You know, that whole, you know, it's it's kind of cliche, but, oh, I want to work in the basement and I'm going to work on this game for a year. Well, a lot of us don't have that opportunity. If you're able to work on your craft sure. for years in a basement and have financial security, even if you have a like a low right. paying job, you know that you have this net. If you don't have that net, you're not going to right. be able to create that opportunity. You know what I mean? And so that's the thing that I see a lot of us struggling with. These guys will get a job. Like one of the folks that I'm working with, he works at Google. Adam works at Google. He has a family. And he's like doing this on the side. There's no way he's going to give up that Google job to go into indie development because there's no net. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the things that I think folks deal with who are underrepresented, you know?
Interesting. Okay.
That's so there. I don't know. What have you seen in this, in that kind of space?
You know, I think that I'm seeing more women developers come start companies, you know, so that's really encouraging to see. And, you know, I'm seeing on that end of things. And so I think as we democratize game development more, I think funding is more available. I think you'll see, you know, incremental changes, improvements and all that.
I think so, too. I think that disparity of gender is different and we do need more representation there for sure, especially with ideas. But more women are now playing games. It's crazy, right? Right. So like, we need women-led studios. I think that when we're talking about that, though, there's still a differentiation between that and minority. We need more minorities in executive positions, and not in a way where it feels like where there's a quota. That doesn't work. We just need there needs to be great people in these positions. And like I was saying with the VC situation, a lot of folks don't know how to get into those conversations, but there's great people that should be in those conversations, right? And so once that happens, then there will be an understanding of the people that need the help and how to get those people to get those opportunities. Like, I think that's the main thread that I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing good work there. Yeah, it's fantastic work that you're doing.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Happy to help out with that too.
Yeah. We definitely need to connect on that stuff. What are you seeing as far as the trends of? Let's just go back to AI real quick. Yeah. Of AI and
yeah, I mean, I think
work with you.
I think there's a lot of interest when there are technological changes happening, and we didn't mention Web3, but Web3 just a year ago or 2 years ago was the technological change that was spurring on a lot of new experiments and startups and companies, and a lot of talented engineers and developers wanted to play with that technology and built Web3 games and are building Web3 games. And now we're fortunate to have another one, which is AI. And I think that's what's attracting a lot of talent and money and time and experiments. And I always find these changes really important to industries. We've seen that with games, games is constantly, what's the next platform? What's the next technology? And that's what makes games really exciting. And that's where I continue to see companies being formed, is just chasing after the next new thing.
Yeah, that's
and that's always
yeah, that's
fun.
That's interesting.
With each of these technological changes, there are also new novel legal questions that keep us busy and keep our work interesting.
That makes sense.
We can really leverage our expertise to try to help companies navigate the legal issues and think through what are the best positions they should have. Because everything's kind of so dynamic and moving that it takes kind of our experience and understanding of technology to really help guide companies through all that.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. Because you were talking about Web3, and I know we only have a few minutes left. I was about to, this is just straight up. How do you spot the grifters?
Well, the grifters have, what's been interesting in the last 6 months, I'd say, just a little bit of word on that. I think the grifters have left, you know, the industry. Okay. It's, no longer is it a path to just create something and sell it for a lot of money, because the market just doesn't exist. That's just not possible anymore. And so
yeah,
I think they've gone off to do something else. The people that are still in Web3 are doing really interesting things around, continue to build around NFTs, digital assets, really interesting ideas. I just saw, I think yesterday, EA announced something with a partnership with Nike on crypto.
Oh, that's cool.
So I think it'll slowly continue. I think it's a good thing. Like, experimenting without a lot of fanfare might be the way to go. A lot of, and it allows for people to try things new and not necessarily have everyone be attracted to the thing that goes up in value quickly. In the end, it's a technology around decentralized services and digital scarcity. And I think developers, some developers are generally interested in playing with that technology and creating new game experiences. And so that's what's exciting for me to see is now that some of the, you know, bubbleness of it all has dissipated. It's still happening. It's just at a more muted way, but I think it's good for the industry.
Yeah, because every time there's a wave, there are those like awesome, passionate people. Then there's the grifters that come along. Do you see that there's like a time frame for that? Because like, you know, AI right now, people are like jumping this wave, AI, whatever the next wave mm-hmm. is. What do you think that the time frame is for that to be like to play out with the bubble, you know, these kind of bubbles?
I think it's hard to predict. Yeah, I think it's hard to predict. But with a lot of money, it draws a lot of people to those.
Yeah, that makes sense.
To those shiny objects.
Yeah.
So, of all types.
Just for the developers and publishers out there or folks that want to work with you, how do you pick clients?
Again, think longer term with the clients I want to work with. I want to work with people who I can help grow into larger companies. A lot of companies may not be suited for, you know, Wilson Sonsini is a large firm, so we offer a lot of services. You know, we're best suited for companies that are going to probably leverage those services over time. Initially, maybe not so much, but as they desire to grow bigger and bigger, they get bigger and bigger, they'll tap into our experts in D.C. and on regulatory issues or experts in Brussels on privacy. Those are the types of companies that tend to kind of work well with us. But the thing is, you can never tell who ends up being going down that path. So I think people who are genuinely building great games, that's just going to end up being successful and lead to a lot of growth. And so I think it's kind of intangible as to how we decide who we work with, but we generally talk to everyone.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, because I think, again, we were talking about the intimidation factor. Some indies are like, not just indies, I think people are sometimes just intimidated.
Well, that's where sometimes they think they can think about having someone like us on their side.
Yeah, yeah.
To, you know, to even out maybe some of the power imbalances in these discussions.
Well, this has been a really awesome conversation.
Great for having me. Thanks for having me here. This is awesome.
Yeah. We should talk more. We should get developers and different folks to have questions to get answered or topics or something.
I think I'm sure there are companies that we can share with you and vice versa.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks for coming out.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Yeah, for sure.
It's great to also just sit down and meet with you again.
Yeah. Where can we find out where can we find out more about the incubator, accelerator?
Like, yeah, I mean, it's on our website, wsgr.com, and there's a URL specifically for it, which escapes my head, but you can click on our gaming channel there and get to it.
Cool. Again, I'm with Jonathan Chan. This is Sonsini. Justin Woodward. We're going to close this thing out.
Thank you.
Peace.